Good afternoon. My name is James Hallibut from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, and I'd like to welcome our listeners to today's Object of History Forum. The Object of History is a joint project between the Center for History and New Media and the Smithsonian National Museum of American History to provide students and teachers around the country with a look at key objects from the collection. Today we continue our discussion about the dress that Mary Todd Lincoln's dress that the museum owns. We're going to continue our discussion from last time with Barbara Clark Smith, who's a curator at the Smithsonian with the Division of Politics and Reform, and Lisa Kathleen Grady, the deputy chair and also a curator at the Division of Politics and Reform. So, welcome again, ladies.
Hello.
Hi, James.
Well, we have lots of questions for you today. I think we're going to start with a softball question that you may disagree about, but maybe we can reach some sort of consensus. Stephen from Virginia would like to know about how many slaves were in the United States at the time that the Emancipation Proclamation was issued. So maybe we could start with Lisa Kathleen. Could you start with that?
I believe it's about 4 million is the estimate at the time, slaves in the United States at the time of the Emancipation Proclamation. Of course, the Emancipation Proclamation did not free all of the slaves, only the slaves in rebel territories.
Right.
Right. It's also useful, now I think probably there are about 27 million white people, white Americans counted by the census, 4 million enslaved African Americans. So when you say 4 million, that's about 1/8 of the total population of the United States. Again, not counting native peoples who weren't counted in the census.
All right. Do we have a sense, as a follow-up, do we have a sense of how many free blacks there might have been in America at the time?
I'm not really sure of that. I know there were, there may have been, 100,000, or more than that. I'm not really certain. There were substantial free black populations in northern cities. There had been blacks freed at the time of the American Revolution, north and south, but the southern states made it increasingly hard for free blacks to live in the south as they saw them as potential supporters of slave uprisings, and that their very presence suggested to slaves that maybe they could get to be free. So between the American Revolution and the Civil War, the free black population moves to cities such as Philadelphia, where there's a very strong population with churches and self-help institutions and schools, New York, to some degree Boston, and of course also in the agricultural north. But you're more aware of them as population groups in the cities.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I don't know the real number of free blacks. That would be interesting to know.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, Barbara, let's talk about class for just a second. It came up in a couple of our questions last time, and I'm wondering if you could describe for us, or at least try to describe this, whether there was a strong sense of separate classes, that we have a sort of a notion of a class-based system and people aware of their sort of sphere.
Sorry, you have reached the maximum length for our recording. To send this message, press 1. To listen to
your
message, press 3.
An answering machine.
To re-record it, press 4. To add to it, press 5. To cancel, press 6.
Yeah, well, we didn't touch anything. So.
That's all right. We'll edit that out.
To send this message, press 1. To listen to your message, press 3. To re-record it, press 4. To add to it, press 5. To cancel, press 6. If you would like to try an extension, you may do so now.
My gosh.
Goodbye. So I guess you're going to have to delete that on your voicemail. We'll edit that out. But I guess I'd like to know whether you could describe for us whether our notion of a very strong class-based system, or at least awareness of class, is as strong as we perceive it to be in the past.
Oh, I think it was quite strong in the 19th century. If you go back to the American Revolution, there is a notion at the time of the Revolution that the revolutionaries are feeling one of the things we don't want in America the kind of aristocracy they had in the old world. We don't want lords ruling over vassals. We don't want hereditary aristocracy. And, of course, the Declaration of Independence and the revolution that follows gets rid of the notion of inherited monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a very strong idea against inherited positions. But, of course, a lot of people do inherit wealth, and when they do inherit wealth, they inherited, they got a good education, they inherited leisure, they learned to be upper class and to take part in upper class activities. And
mm-hmm.
that was a small minority of people who set themselves off. And in the course of the 19th century, you definitely see a conflict between those who want to keep emphasizing relative egalitarianism and those who are very comfortable with great gulfs of wealth and hierarchies.
Mm-hmm.
And this comes into play, of course, in the Civil War, where some of the opposition of small northern farmers to the southern elite was that they were these rich planters. Of course, only some minority of southern slaveholders were rich planters, and a minority of southerners were slaveholders. So there, too, there were class differences. But you had a tension between a world where most people live in a rural society, there's a lot of middling and small farmers that are hoping to move out onto the frontier and get more land. That's one of the reasons why there's disputes about the movement west and whether slavery should move west, because it moves west, that's less land for small white families to be on small farms. Instead, that would be taken up by larger plantations worked by slaves. So there's a rural issue, and then in the cities, you both have the growth of industry in the north, so you have factory workers, growing numbers of relatively poor people, Irish, Germans, and then the second part of the century from many other parts of Europe and the world coming into work, often very poor. And then you have a middle class of people who work in shops and stores, reaching up to people who then own the shops and stores, people with various skills, people who produce various things. So there are a range of groups. There's not like one group and another, as you have in the South, where you have a slave owner and slave. There's certain stark moments like that.
Right.
But there's a range of different classes. But those differences are very important and very controversial. And part of why a lot of northern white farmers are opposed to slavery, some of it's sympathy for the slave or support for the worker, but some of it is simply opposition to the kind of hierarchical society that they think slavery supports. Of course, industrialization also supports a certain hierarchical society. So by the end of the century, you get into the Gilded Age with those large fortunes made by men owning railroads or from steel or from oil. So in some ways, things were getting less equal in the course of the century. But it was an ongoing struggle back and forth. In some ways, it got more equal because slaves did get free.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. We know from the historical record that runaway slaves or slaves who for whatever reason, left the plantation, some of them presumably moved north, but we know that some of them looked for refuge, either in hiding or escaping or for travel. And so we're aware of, for example, the 15th Street Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C., and we know that there's a connection with Elizabeth Keckley to that. Can you briefly describe, Barbara, what sort of services that particular church and churches like it might have provided for African Americans like Elizabeth Keckley?
Well, there's two parts to an answer. One is what kind of services does it supply to the free community of African Americans
mm-hmm.
who are the members, people like Elizabeth Keckley. And she's
right.
pretty well off in the sense that she's working at the White House or for the White House and becomes very successful working for elite white Washingtonians. And there are a whole group of other African Americans in Washington, D.C. who have that role. people who either work for the White House or work for leading white figures in the government, people who are servants, people who are caterers, people who run boarding houses, people who are cooks. Those people attend a church such as 15th Street Presbyterian, and for them, it's the same kind of institution that, in many ways, much like the white church, equivalent of the white church of the day, provides a spiritual home and a social home and a place to a focus for community and for moral work and for connection with others. Then, when the war breaks out, there's a gap of time between the beginning of the war and the emancipation. And, of course, even after the Emancipation Proclamation, it isn't actually put into effect until the Union Army gets someplace and can actually, the slaves can get away.
Mm-hmm.
So long before people are legally free, they vote with their feet. They free themselves. They run off to Union lines. And these people are called contraband,
mm-hmm.
as if they were goods seized by the Union Army, because they were property taken by the Union Army. But the Union Army wasn't about to return them to the enemy, the slaveholders. So these people, the question was, what could an institution like 12th Street Presbyterian do for them? These people were destitute with nothing but the clothes on their backs, often. The able-bodied men among them worked for the Union Army or for the government, and the able-bodied women also worked, but they needed the sorts of services that the 15th Street Presbyterian Church and other groups, other northern groups, raised money to give them, which is housing, clothing, literacy. Many of them desperately wanted to learn to read. Many of them desperately wanted such things as to have their marriages legalized. They wanted to learn the basic skills and have the basic prerequisites of becoming a citizen. So at least in the short term, a place like 15th Street Presbyterian gathered money, and individual members would travel to the Freedmen's Village where refugees were living to teach them and tend to them.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
Is actually one of the founders of a, I'm going to lose the exact name, the Contraband Relief Association.
That's right.
And Interdisciplinary Lincoln in the association approaches the plight of the freedmen and asks for Mrs. Lincoln's help. Mrs. Lincoln is extremely interested, gives money herself, and works some on helping Mrs. Keckley raise money, and mentions the subject to her husband, the president.
Okay.